On this week's Louisiana Eats, we're going whole hog. Literally. First, Ryan Fertel, author of One True Barbecue, demystifies the role of the pitmaster in the famous whole hog barbecue of the Carolinas.
The title of the book is The One True Barbecue. A better title might be My One True Barbecue, because whole hog really became my thing, my passion, my obsession.
Then, boucherie chef Nathaniel Zimmet welcomes us into his restaurant kitchen to show us his method of deconstructing that whole hog.
Dude is like, why do you want to work here? And I was like, I really like butchery. I want to just get better at it. I'm really interested. He's like, we don't really get in whole animals. You're just going to be making a lot of sausage, a lot of sausage. And I'm like, that sounds so cool.
It's time for Here Piggy 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 on this week's Louisiana Eats. But first, the news. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889, and by French Market Coffee, locally roasted in New Orleans for 125 years. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. In the South, barbecue time isn't just summertime. It's all the time. On this week's show, we're cooking up the pig in every way you can imagine. First, Ryan Fertel addresses the state of whole hog barbecue, a dying art crafted by a very special breed, something he discovered while researching his new book, The One True Barbecue. Then, we visit Chef Michael Galata on his patio at MoFo, where every week he cooks a whole hog using ingredients that some of those Carolina pitmasters might not even recognize. And finally, it's time to dissect the pig. No one does that better than boucherie chef Nathaniel Zimmet. He welcomes us into the kitchen for the deconstruction of a whole hog. There's no way around it. We're going whole hog on this week's Louisiana Eats. While writing his new book, The One True Barbecue, Ryan Fertel observed the intense physical labor of whole hog pitmasters at work. Surprisingly, he was reminded of his own mother at work. You see, Ryan spent much of his childhood in the Lafayette location of his grandmother's restaurant, which was managed by his mother. Who was his grandmother? None other than Ruth Fertel, founder of Ruth's Chris Steakhouse. Ryan shared this memory of his mom, Rosemary Parisi, who was the first to show him the toil and beauty of a butcher's work.
The saw and the meat, combined with the promise of smoke and fire, did more than excite a version of Southern exoticism within me. These rituals unlocked a deeply held memory. I was instantly and quite uncomfortably put in mind of my mother, who, in one of my earliest recollections, I could see slashing through a short loin with an electric bandsaw. Her thriving steakhouse, and this was the days before prepackaged cryovac steaks, cut the following day's quota of New York strips, fillets, and ribeyes. When any given employee became a no-show, my mom took up his position, even if that meant being the butcher. It was brutal, violent work, not maternal in the least. And the next 15 minutes went by in the blur and the whine of the saw blade. By the time Gabriel had stopped reveling in the rendering of pig flesh, 12 disembodied trotters stood piled in the truck's bed. I was sickened. I was thrilled. I was hungry.
Through stories told in artful prose, Ryan's book takes us through the best whole hog barbecue joints in Tennessee and the Eastern Carolinas, pillars of a sustained tradition whose numbers are dwindling. We sat down with Ryan to discuss his exhaustive research on the book, a process that led him to some of the smokiest storied barbecue shacks in America. Ryan began by describing Ricky Parker, one of his all-time whole hog heroes.
Ricky was a man, a pit master, a barbecue cook that I met in the summer of 2008. I was working for the Southern Foodways Alliance. They had sent me to West Tennessee to document barbecue culture. And there in Memphis, I ate barbecue almost every day that summer. I ate barbecue sometimes five times a day. I didn't necessarily enjoy myself or fall in love with barbecue as a thing. I didn't love barbecue too much before that. But in Lexington, Tennessee, where Ricky Parker's Scott's Barbecue restaurant was, I found something completely different, completely new. Ricky was – he was cooking whole hogs. So these are entire pigs. And Ricky – he was never content with cooking just one. He was also too busy to cook just one. So he would strive to cook as many as possible. He would cook a dozen sometimes over a weekend night. His great goal in life, he told me over and over, I'd visit him every year after 2008, was to cook 100 whole hogs over an Independence Day weekend. So I, after that first visit, fell in love with his food, but also kind of fell for the guy. He was a bit of a character. I never knew if he would be open. He was in and out of certain dependency issues. He liked to say that he was married to his restaurant more than he was to his wives. He thought that he was the last of the great whole hog pitmasters. In a sense, he was right. He grew up in that part of Tennessee, West Tennessee, just about an hour and a half, 2 hours east of Memphis. They didn't cook shoulders. They didn't cook ribs. They cooked entire pigs. But in the 70s and the 80s, these places start to disappear.
Why do you think, because obviously you bought into this, why is whole hog barbecue the one true barbecue?
Yeah, so the title of the book is The One True Barbecue. A better title might be My One True Barbecue, because whole hog really became my thing, my passion, my obsession. Ricky liked to say that a whole hog contains every part of the pig, and he's right. So when you go to Scott's Barbecue today, it's now run by Ricky's two children, you can really order any part of that animal. So you can pick a little bit of shoulder, a little bit of ham, a little bit of belly meat, a little bit of tenderloin, and you could have this mixed and matched. You could have a little bit chopped or sliced. So you're kind of imagining the perfect sandwich. Mm-hmm. I think he's right. There's something about the sustainability of eating a whole animal. He didn't talk in those terms. But there's something about being able to eat anything you want off of this carcass.
Snout to tail.
Yeah.
Walk us through the families across Tennessee and the Carolinas who really dominate whole hog barbecue. Who are these people?
Well, when we think of family history and barbecue and whole hog barbecue especially, we got to talk about the Jones family in Nadon. Pete Jones opened the Skylight Inn in 1947. He was a teenager. He was a teenager in an agricultural town. He didn't have a lot of prospects. And so he opened what amounted to a bar room serving hamburgers and maybe the whole hog barbecue that his barbecue forefathers had cooked before him. So he opens this place. You know, it was never really popular. It somehow remained open. It fed people very cheaply. This was an agricultural town. This is where people would go for a beer and a bite of barbecue and coleslaw and the cornbread after work. But then in the 1970s, National Geographic comes by. So National Geographic sent a pair of reporters, a writer and a photographer, on the road. And they are traveling around eastern North Carolina. They're looking for the best barbecue. They're eating bite after bite of barbecue. They're liking what they eat, they say. And then according to the Jones family, according to Pete Jones, this was the story he always told. And if you go to the Skylight Inn, it's written on the walls. This is the story they'll tell. The reporters come into the Skylight Inn and they say, "Sir, we've heard you have some good barbecue." And he says, "I think I do have some good barbecue. Let me try. Let me let you all try it." So he gives them some chopped whole hog, and they taste the barbecue, and they say, "This is the best barbecue we've ever had. You, sir, have built the capital of barbecue." And so after that, Pete Jones started using that phrase, capital of barbecue. He even built a replica of the U.S. Capitol Dome on top of his restaurant, and you can see it from a mile away potentially. It glitters like silvery white in the sun. It's ridiculous looking, but it's beautiful. And that story is not true, or it's only half true. The National Geographic reporters did step in to Pete Jones's barbecue, and he said, "Boys, I have the best barbecue sandwich you've ever had in your life. I own the capital of barbecue." They took his words, put it in print, and after it was in print, then he built his dome.
That's hilarious. Well, that barbecue, it's hard work, no matter which way you slice, dice it, or chop it.
It is brutal work. This whole hog business is brutal, brutal work. It's not your ordinary barbecue. So you're not only cooking like Ricky Parker did from dusk to dawn, but you're working in the smoke-filled pit house. And it is smoke-filled because the hogs require constant shoveling. So you have to shovel fresh hardwood coals under these pigs about every 20 minutes. This is throughout the night. A lot of times, these pigs explode. They're constantly dripping grease on these coals that lie just a foot underneath them. And if this grease catches fire, it can run kind of up, come almost gravitate. The fire gravitates, catches the hog on fire. And we'll burn the whole pit house down in a matter of minutes. Every single pit house I've been to has burned down.
You were pretty brave because you spent a fair amount of time in there. And there was one particular passage in the book where the smoke alone was just really overwhelming and got to you.
Well, I don't know if I was brave. I mean, I was reporting. And so a lot of the book is about sitting with these pit masters throughout the night, sitting by the fire, staring into the fire, encouraging them to tell me stories, any kind of stories, beyond trying to go beyond barbecue and the process that they do. But while sitting in these pit houses, I did have to inhale a bunch of smoke, and I would feel unhealthy after a night in these pit houses. A lot of these pit masters have worked in these places, in these smokehouses, for 30, 40, 50 years or more. A lot of them also smoke tobacco. So the existences that they lead they're tough. They're tough guys. They kind of adhere very stubbornly to this tradition.
Ryan, share with us your thoughts on race and barbecue in America, because you came across one particularly offensive racist who almost took his empire down due to his unfortunate thoughts about segregation.
Well, Maurice Bessinger, who recently passed away, but for a long time, for almost half a century, he ran a barbecue empire out of Columbia, South Carolina. And Maurice was, to call him a complicated man would be unfair to complicated people. He was an outright racist. So you'd walk into his restaurant, and I've been into his restaurant twice. There was this massive portrait of him in a white suit astride a white horse. Next to that would be a stack of books for sale, his biography, which was covered in the Confederate flag. And, you know, it was a book full of race theory. He thought that, segregation of the races was the healthiest thing for the United States. I read this biography. It's horrific. It's no longer for sale, as I understand, in his restaurant since he passed away. But I was always very shocked both times I went by what was for sale, what was on the wall, the shrines to Maurice Bessinger. And there were other pamphlets there about the neo-Confederacy in this. And the diversity not only among the employees, among the staff, but also in the dining room. Among the customers, it was a very strange experience, and to me, it made the barbecue not taste good. I couldn't leave that place thinking, "Oh, this was a good meal." But he did build an empire. It is a very popular chain of restaurants. He has his own sauce.
Well, you eloquently describe sort of having to swallow a bit of nausea just to get in the door there. You know, he's just going to hit every nerve in the book, isn't he?
Yeah. And I mean, the heart of the book is this chapter about a man named Keith Ward. Keith Ward goes by the name of Pop, and he cooks at a place in Goldsboro, North Carolina, called Wilbur's Barbecue. He's an African-American man, and he's very aware of this history. He's been working at Wilbur's for over three decades. His father has been there for for over 50 years. He still worked there one day a week. He's in his 80s, his father. And Keith and I talked about race and barbecue. He was very open to sharing. He was very open to talking about what he thinks is unfair and what I, you know, came around to thinking was unfair. Mr. Wilbur is immensely famous in that part of the Carolinas. Keith Ward is nameless. He's anonymous. Keith Ward's face is not on the walls of Wilbur's barbecue. But all the celebrities that Mr. Wilbur Shirley has fed over the years, all the presidents that have visited his restaurant are on the walls. But Keith and his father are completely absent. And there's something very wrong there. Is it about race? Maybe. You know, I think it's a lot about restaurant culture, a lot about work culture in America. It's a lot about the South. But it is no different in the North. I think it's indicative of what really goes on in between the back of the house and the front of the house in restaurants.
Well, bravo to you for doing this research and bringing all these people's stories to the forefront. I can only imagine all the pitmasters present and past and all of the great steak folks gone on to meet their maker who are smiling at you and your beautiful book. Thank you, Ryan. Thanks so much for sharing this with us.
Thank you, Poppy. This was wonderful.
Ryan Fertel, author of The One True Barbecue.
I got a kind-hearted woman.
When we come back from a short break, we're headed over to MoFo in New Orleans Mid-City, where Chef Michael Galata is cooking up a whole hog. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and by Ralph Brennan's Redfish Grill. From dock to pot, offering 9 varieties of fresh fish daily, plucked straight from the Gulf. Lunch, dinner, and private events at 115 Bourbon Street in the French Quarter. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and by Ralph Brennan's Redfish Grill. From dock to pot, offering 9 varieties of fresh fish daily, plucked straight from the Gulf. Lunch, dinner, and private events at 115 Bourbon Street in the French Quarter. Michael Galata, recognized by Food & Wine magazine in 2016 as one of America's best new chefs, hosts a celebration at his mid-city restaurant, MoFo, every weekend. Out on the restaurant's patio is a huge fire pit where he roasts a whole hog on a spit suspended over an open flame. The whole process takes so many hours that no one gets a taste of the pig until Saturday. But Michael invited us to join him at the Smoky Pit on Friday to see just how he does it.
This is Michael Galata, chef partner of MoFo Restaurant in Mid-City, New Orleans, and today we are doing our weekly hog roast.
It's weekly.
It is weekly. Every Saturday.
Everybody loves that whole hog.
It has developed a bit of a following, which we're happy about.
I'd like to know why you're cooking a whole hog. Why do you do this?
I would say the reason is when we were first opening the restaurant, the whole idea was what would a cook want to eat on his day off? And so we thought, you know, what better way to celebrate every Saturday in New Orleans?
Let's start at the beginning. Where does this hog come from?
We get our hogs from 2 different places, either Home Place Pastures, which is an open range farm, and then the other one is Chapapeo Farms, which is actually really close, right on the north shore of the lake in Husser, Louisiana.
What's the average weight on this hog when you get it in?
So we found the sweet spot is between 75 and 85 pounds. It's just right to where you get a good yield off the hog, you get a whole lot of skin, but it's not so big to where it has to cook too long and it gets dry. Because at some point, the hog is going to be there for way too long just to get it cooked all the way to the bone. to make it tender, and the meat can get dry. Whereas with an 85-pound hog, it's just perfect. By the time it's done all the way in the middle, the outside's still juicy. There's a really good fat-to-meat ratio. And we just find it's the, I don't know, it's just the fattiest, most delicious hog when it's done.
Walk us through the process.
It's a three-day process. We get them in, and so we rub them down with a mixture of sugar, salt, and Korean red pepper flake. And then we load it into a cooler and cover it with bags of ice. And so it basically cures overnight. So that it's basically like brining it, like a dry brine or a dry rub. So that sugar and that salt really act on the skin and the meat and really flavor it. And then the next day we rinsed all the salt and sugar off the skin. We left it on the inside because we rubbed the body cavity down too. We left all that's all fine. But that skin, because we want to fry that skin later.
Yeah.
And if we leave that salt and that sugar on that skin, it'll be really salty when we fry it. It won't be edible. So we rinse all that sugar and salt off, or wipe it off, load them onto the rack, onto the pit by 9 a.m. It'll roast all day Friday. We used to roast it overnight on Saturday night, on Friday night to Saturday morning.
But that's too hard for you to stay up all night.
Well, we started having like a lottery where one cook would have to stay. We started coming back and finding like parties, like beer cans everywhere. So they were inviting all their friends over. And at first we were kind of okay with that, but then it got a little crazy. So some of the parties got a little out of hand. So the pig parties got out of hand. So now the pig gets roasted on Friday, and then we let it rest because we pull it off late Friday night and let it rest until Saturday morning, and then we pick the whole pig. And then when you order it, so we pick the whole pig for the reason of we want you to get a little bit of shoulder, a little bit of belly, a little bit of a backstrap, a little bit of a ham, because all those different parts have different moisture levels and different textures. So we pick it all together. And we take the skin off and we scrape all that really delicious fat off the inside layer of the skin, and we chop that up really fine, and we mix that in with the meat as well.
Mm.
So just to add all that delicious fattiness. And then so when we take those skins after we scraped all the fat off, we drop those in the fryer and puff them up like cracklings. And they've been smoking for 10 hours, so they're basically like bacon by the time they're fried.
You know, visuals on the radio are tough.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of people who think about seeing a pig roasting, it's sort of like there's that little round pig, and he's going round and round.
Mm-hmm.
But here, you've got the pig flayed, completely flat.
Yes.
Why is it done that way?
It cooks faster, for one, and a little more evenly. We don't have a continuous rotating spit, so usually when they wrap them up like that, it's because they continually rotate. These pigs are a little too big for that. The rack itself weighs 30 pounds. So 35 pounds, and so when you strap an 85-pound pig to that, suddenly you got a really heavy pig that a motor is, you have to have a big motor to turn it slowly.
It's a workout for the cook.
Well, yeah, so for us, we flay it like that, so we can just, every 30 minutes or so, we just come turn it 180 degrees.
How did you learn how to do this?
We taught ourselves. I say we because, you know, at MOFO, it's a kitchen of guys and girls that I really love and trust, and we're busy, so there's no real one person that can sit out here and tinker with it. So we've all kind of traded off and thrown in our own ideas. Like now now we do a rub on it with coconut oil, ginger, garlic, lemongrass, that we grind it all up in the blender and then brush it on as the pig roasts.
Oh, so that's what's in the magic bowl over there.
Yes, and so it gets mopped every hour with that. And so everyone's just kind of added their little bit.
And how often does it get turned?
About half an hour to 45 minutes.
You have a timer going in there nonstop?
No, we just kind of do it.
This is your internal clock.
Yep. Like I said, we don't really have a... People are always like, oh, what do you know? They try to ask all the particulars, and we don't really have particulars. We're like, oh, how hot do you keep it? I'm like, well, we put our hand between the flame and the pig, and if it hurts, it's hot enough. That's what we figure. That's kind of the way we do it. So we're not overly technical.
You have this great experience where you can eat the whole pig and all the various parts that you mix up. But there's got to be some pig leftovers. What do you do with that?
There are no pig leftovers. The bones we use the bones to make our pork pho, which we serve, and then which is a special every week. And then the head gets turned into the head cheese that you can get in the pho. The feet go to our dogs.
Lucky dogs.
Yeah.
Michael, you're the chef here.
Yes.
Ultimately, this is your pig.
Right.
You pull the pig off. Which is your secret part of the pig that you eat?
Like to eat? Oh. I would say my favorite is right at the end of the ribs. So like right where the ribs meet the belly. That's a really delicious area to just kind of pull apart and chew on. There's like these little gelatinous bits that are covered in smoky meat.
Yum.
That's awesome. Or I would say the cheeks.
When you opened your restaurant, when you were planning MOFO, Why did you put this outdoor grill in? Did you have this in mind?
No. It's really funny how that happened, because originally this whole deck wasn't supposed to be here. This was actually just going to be like a delivery area. And then when we were, but it was kind of beat up. It needed to be paved. And we asked our landlord, who's actually been really good to us, hey, can we pave that, or can you pave it? And he said, well, I mean, you're technically closing it in on three sides. I can't do anything else with it. Why don't you just take it and do whatever you want with it? And so we decided to build a deck, and we had to build a retaining wall anyway. And so while they were building the wall, I was looking at it while they were building it, and I knew there was going to be a deck, and I said, well, why can't we just build 2 footers off that wall, and then we can just build a pit?
Michael, thank you so much for letting us come out here on the patio and participate in the pig roast.
I'm just glad you're interested in the pig roast.
Well, we're going to have to eat.
Please do.
Okay. After the whole hog rested overnight, we joined Michael again on Saturday morning in Mofo's kitchen for a taste.
So after that pig comes off the spit.
Right.
What does he do? He comes in and he rests for a while?
He does. He rests, so that way when we break him apart, all the juices are back in the meat. Because if we pick him apart while he's really hot off, all that juice will just pour right out and we'll lose it.
Right.
Yeah, definitely. So then, we take all the bits and pieces. The back strap and the shoulders and the belly and the leg, and we cut it all up. And we mix it all together. That way you get a little bit of everything. And then when you order it, it's going to go onto the griddle, and it's going to get all delicious and caramelized, and we're going to add coconut milk, and we're going to add lemongrass and ginger and garlic and chili.
Yum.
All right?
Yeah.
So we're going to do that right now. A little oil on our griddle.
How would you describe the different flavor profiles that you get from the different types of the pig?
I would say it's more about the texture of each piece.
Okay.
So, you know, the back strap's a little more tender, whereas the shoulder's a little more fatty, and of course the belly's very fatty. And so when you put all these pieces together, that's when you get something really special, because you get a little bit of all that, different textures. Of course, it's been smoking for 10 hours, so it's got that nice smokiness to it. But it's also, we cure it with a little bit of sugar, so it's also got some nice sugars in there that naturally caramelize when we put them on the griddle. So you get these nice little charred, crunchy, sweet, caramelized bits.
Yeah.
And then, to make it really delicious, we put a little bit of lemongrass, ginger, and garlic. We call that the love, the Mofo love. It's because we put it on our wings as well, and it's called the Mofo love.
Okay.
And so that goes, we use it in a lot of things. In another lifetime, I ran a French restaurant, and everything had shallot, garlic, and thyme in it. But here at Mofo, we do garlic, ginger, and lemongrass. And it pretty much goes in everything we make. So once we have some nice caramelization going, then comes the secret ingredient. Coconut milk steeped with chili flake. Which doesn't want to do with, there we go. And so that coconut milk, since we're throwing it onto this hot griddle, it's going to really quickly reduce down and get really dark and rich. And it's going to pick up all the little bits of caramelized pork that were on the griddle. And then we have this really beautiful color going on, and the flavor is just delicious. All right.
Adds that little bit of red color and just kind of brightens it up.
Oh yeah. So this is where we want to be. So next, we take the skin and we drop them right in the fryer. So it's fun having a kitchen we can cheat, because traditionally, at the very end of the hog roast, you would really put a whole lot of fire on, a whole lot of wood on the fire, and let that intense heat make the skin into crackling on the pig. But, you know, we got a bunch of deep fryers, so it comes out much more puffed and delicious when you just drop it into 360-degree grease.
And doing it to order, there's something to be said about that.
Yeah, it's delicious.
This is not your Cajun daddy's boucherie, is it?
No, but the crackling's extra special because it's been slow-stoked for so long that it really is almost like bacon by the time you're done. We have one more thing to do. We have to cook our roti.
Okay.
So now, we're going to cook some roti.
What is that?
Ooh. Roti is originally Indian, which is Indian flatbread, but then it was, pardon me one second, it's a very hot pot he's got coming. But then was sort of adopted by the Southeast Asians, Thai and Vietnamese. And so it's a really thin flatbread, traditionally made with ghee or butter, but we make it with Creole cream cheese. All right. So while those are getting golden brown, we'll make our plate. So delicious caramelized pork on the nice big mound on the plate. All the reduced coconut milk over the top. Top it with a big piece of crispy crackling. And then we have our house pickles, which are summer squash, summer zucchini, and it changes the time of year. In the winter, there'll be cauliflower in there. And we do a spicy curry pickle. And then our nuoc chom, pardon me. The nuoc chom is a traditional Vietnamese dipping sauce. It's fish sauce, garlic, jalapenos, a little vinegar, sugar, and it's just the perfect, because it's kind of acidic, but it's also kind of, it has this kind of umami fishiness to it, so it's perfect for that fatty pork. And then our beautiful pieces of roti, which we just fold up, place right next to it, and you can hear them kind of crunching and being delicious. And then we do what we call it our pig herbs.
And what are the pig herbs?
Cilantro, mint, basil, and then when in the summer when we have it, we do purple perilla, which is also called shiso. And that is our pork platter.
Well, that is just gorgeous, Chef. Now, will you take us out into the dining room and show us how to eat it?
Heck yeah.
Okay. Okay, so of course, here at MoFo, what utensils would we eat this with? Frankly, it looks like something you could almost just eat with your fingers.
I would prefer to eat with hands. This dish, I mean, some people eat it with a fork and just sort of pick things together and then I'll dip it in the sauce. The best way, the way it's meant to be eaten is you unfold the roti.
Yes.
And then, I mean, the pork might be a little hot, so it's not too hot right now. We put all the meat in there in the center, top it with the pickles. And then, more importantly, a little bit of the crackling. And then some of those fresh herbs. And then you wrap the whole thing up, dip it, and eat it.
Yum.
So, who's eating? Would you like?
Oh, you have the first bite.
All right, I'm gonna have the first bite.
Tell me how it tastes, Chef.
Pretty good. Would you like to eat one for yourself?
Okay.
I'm actually really enjoying this.
Me too. Well, thank you, Michael. I'm so grateful we got to go through the whole pig experience right here with you at MoFo.
You're welcome. I'm still eating pig.
Michael Galata, chef partner at MoFo. How is bacon actually cured? And what is curing anyway? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and by French Market Coffee. Every premium blend of French Market Coffee contains a richness that can only be called New Orleans bold. Made from the finest beans, slow roasted in small batches, only one coffee captures the bold flavor of our one-of-a-kind city. French Market Coffee. New Orleans. Bold. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How is bacon actually cured? And what is curing anyway? Curing is the chemical and physical processing of meat that allows it to be safely edible for a long period of time. the number one most important ingredient used in curing any meat is salt. Salt draws moisture from the muscle cells by osmosis. That inhibits the production of bacteria, which would cause the meat to spoil. But when curing meat, too little salt is bad because that bacteria can grow without enough salt. And too much salt will make the meat hard, dry, and, well, just too salty. Proper bacon is made with skin-on pork belly, liberally seasoned with a combination of salt and sugar, often brown sugar. It cures in the refrigerator for 7 days. Every day, the pork belly gets turned over so the curing is well distributed. Once the meat is firm, it's rinsed well and dried before being placed on a rack in the refrigerator, where it sits for 12 to 24 hours before it's hot smoked to an internal temperature of 160 degrees. When cooled down, the skin's removed, but don't throw that away. That skin can be fried into some seriously delicious cracklins. I'm Poppy Tooker, and making bacon always makes for some real Louisiana eats. The extensive task of taking apart a whole hog is something that many would find arduous or, frankly, gross. For Nathaniel Zimmet, however, it's an obsession. We join Nathaniel in his kitchen and observe the award-winning chef as he gleefully deconstructed a whole hog.
My name is Nathaniel Zimmet, and I am the chef and owner of Boucherie and Bourré. So we get two hogs a week, and what we do with the meat is we sell it at Bourré in different forms, and we also use it at Boucherie. One thing I try to consider, Bourré is like Boucherie's butcher shop, and so we get to really have this benefit of a whole cooler dedicated to Boucherie. And we get to really begin flavors. For instance, if we're making a gumbo and we make the andouille, that is something that I'm able to direct the flavor from the very beginning. You know, I'm not relying upon somebody else's sausage. I'm relying upon what I want to do. It's wild to get a whole animal in and put it on your board and say, what do I want to do today? Really, we're limited by our imagination. We have the space. We have the ability to do anything.
Well, let's take the pig apart and tell me what you imagine is going to happen with all bits of this pig.
So we look at it, and one thing we look immediately is kind of the size of it. So the hanging weight is 266. It was probably a good 300 pounds. It was a big boy. So
okay,
first things
go.
First, I start looking at the excessive amount of fat. This is this leaf fat. This is stuff that we use. We break this down. We render. We sell lard as well. And we use lard. I don't always use my knife for this. Reason being is there's natural kind of breaks in meat. And that's, you know, the different muscles. And the different muscles will have connective tissue or something. And I can usually kind of snake my finger into it. Whereas my knife hopefully is sharp. And if it's sharp, it doesn't necessarily know the difference between fat and meat. So after I start to take off, after I took off that the big leaf, I start looking around for flank steaks. Flank steaks are the forgotten cut of meat on a pig, in my opinion. They're so amazing. You think about them as you would a skirt or a flank steak from a cow, and they're every bit as good. They're tender. They're wonderful.
Yeah, and it's amazing, really, what a small piece of meat that is, generally speaking. So,
and we generate a few of them. So there's one here, and really, you start to, when you start to pretend, and you look at this whole animal, and you pretend that I don't know what this is, I can start breaking down muscle to muscle to muscle, and imagine how many muscles there are on your belly, you know, and that's what this is. And so if you just, it's just a matter of how you look at it. If you look at it differently, you can really see something else. I'm looking at that, and it just doesn't, you can see by the grain, it just doesn't look like it wants to be there. saying, Nathaniel, please, please, kick me off. It's easy. And then I am forever mindful of this guy right here. This is our tenderloin. And so that will be coming out next.
That's the money meat, right?
That is the money meat. So, take this guy off. And again, I really try to do very little to these muscles. I try to just follow the outsides and let my fingers kind of do a little scouting before my knife does. And then, again, look how easily it just comes right off.
Beautiful. Nathaniel, when did you butcher your first hog?
The first time I butchered a whole hog by myself was in this kitchen. And it was a huge, huge animal. And I remember it was a Monday and we were closed, and I had a bunch of my, some of my employees were here, friends. And I remember squeezing a nipple and milk shooting out of it. And that cleared the room. And then I was able to have peace with my animal. But that was...
Yeah, that'll clear a room.
That was 08. That was 08. 08 probably was the first time. And it's been many, many since. So that's our beautiful little tenderloin. Yeah. It is nice. So to start taking off this guy, I'm going to grab this little flank just because I see it and it's calling my name and it's saying, just please remove me. And then I'll take this back boy off. So what I'll do is I'll go straight down and kind of just try to be as straight as I can. This is my sweet baby, this knife right here. I have a semi full-blown knife addiction.
Yes.
And I always relate. Have. This is a Tanaka. It's a Yodeba. A Yodeba is a Japanese butchery knife. It's slightly smaller than a Deba, and this one, you know, it's flat on one side and has a pretty pronounced secondary angle on the front.
Gorgeous.
It is a beast, and this thing is not, it gets razor sharp, and it's not something that I'm concerned with breaking bones with. And I'll let this beautiful knife do its work. I get my guide cuts.
And it is really beautiful because it follows the natural pattern. There's this beautiful curvature that people who are accustomed to seeing whole fresh hams in a store even would recognize.
It's beautiful. It really is. And honestly, this is, I don't know, when we opened up Bouray, for years, this was part of what my plan has been, is to have a butcher shop. I remember when I first moved into town, I was cooking. I think I was a sous chef at the Bank Cafe under Dan Essis, an awesome guy. And I was working my ass off, but I saw that in the paper Jeans Po' Boys had a position for a butcher, and I applied. And they sat me down and interviewed me. And dude is like, "Why do you want to work here?" And I was like, I really like butchery. I want to just get better at it. I'm really interested. He's like, "We don't really get in whole animals. You're just going to be making a lot of sausage, a lot of sausage." And I'm like, "That sounds so cool." And he just looks at me, and he had another guy with him, and they just are staring at me like I'm an idiot. And they're like, what's your angle? Like, what are you trying to do? And I'm like, I'm just trying to work as a butcher part-time while I'm cooking. And long story short, they never call me back. So I make these lead cuts with my knife. My knife is sharp and it doesn't rip meat. And I try to get as much around that bone as I can, and then I start cutting. And I use the saw very little at this point, and you can hear it went right through.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would expect to hear the whirring of a bandsaw, but no, we've just got a regular old handsaw here.
Yeah,
huh?
These things work really well. It's just all
available at any Ace Hardware store.
I bought this
at
Lowe's. Lowe's, a shop I attend frequently. So, here we are.
It's so interesting because what you're doing now, taking the skin off that pig trotter, it looks like you're just peeling the glove off some lady.
That is exactly why a lot of this traditional charcuterie stuff came about, because you're taking it apart and you're like, why am I not restuffing that glove?
So you get turned away from the poor boy shop when they were alarmed that you were so excited about sausage making.
Are you largely self-taught? How'd you learn this, Nathaniel?
Well, I went to culinary school, the Le Cordon Bleu in London and in Sydney, and certainly that, when I did that, a light bulb went off. I mean, things immediately clicked. I dropped out of university to go to culinary school, and just things immediately clicked. Butchery is an interesting thing. There's so many wonderful books. There's so many really crappy books on charcuterie and whole animal butchery. They're predominantly horrible books, which is so disappointing. But you just, you know, practice makes perfect. I don't think I've ever had somebody really watch over me when I'm butchering a pig to teach me.
What's going to happen with that pigtail? I see you've saved it.
The pigtail goes often to my dog. She's quite a loved, huge animal. She weighs 170 pounds, and she just turned 3.
Oh, my God. What is she?
She's an American Mastiff. Strangely enough, her name is Kikuichi. After the first knife that I held that really felt like it was right.
That's great.
There you go. There you go. True story.
It's all about your tools, isn't it?
It is all about the tools. I'm going to come right back to this and that cut, and I'm going to start working on getting my loin out of there, getting it out of harm's way. And it's interesting, and sometimes I don't always do this the same way. There are many ways to butcher, and I wouldn't say that there's necessarily a right way. You really always need to consider what you're doing with it. And you can never be too humble when you're doing this kind of stuff. And always recognizing that this is what it's all about. It's not like, oh, I'm really good at this, I can do this real fast. You know what? Congratulations. Just don't screw up the meat. I always make bacon or corned pork belly. So I almost always keep this center piece, as I talked about. And even trimming with meaty bones, I still have a lot of belly left. This is our chicharrón, and that will be our lardo. This will be cleans down for that. And here is heaven.
What's heaven on a pig?
Heaven is that pig belly. So let's look at it, and let's look at the edges. The edges really tell the story here, and it tells me what to do with my knife. So look at the side. This is, what does that look like?
Looks like bacon.
Looks like bacon to me too. We look at this side, and we're still in a pretty fat town.
Yeah.
And then this here, the other side, is kind of all over the place. It is technically belly-ish, but really, we just wouldn't do that. And then you have this side, again, fat. So, if you recall, this is where I was taking all those flanks off of. And you really say, oh, I really don't need that. So what I'm gonna do first, and this one is still available, I am gonna take that one off. What I like to do is I like to take the first ones that kind of gets me cleaned up, if you will. And then as I'm getting more into my pig and knowing, figuring out exactly what I need for the week and what I'm doing, then I'll recognize that I have all these other options. And maybe a flank will pop out again. So I'll take a couple of cuts. The other thing to think about too is where you're in your belly. Like, this is too much meat. This is a 2-inch thick part of the belly and literally almost 50% meat, and it's marbled meat, and then another 50% of fat. That 50% of fat is, so it's one thing of meat or protein, another part of fat, and it's one on top of the other, so that's a problem. Whereas I look on this side and I've got meat, fat. I want that. That looks like bacon. And that is a wonderful time to end
the pig.
The pig.
What an incredible job you did here and for us. I'm so grateful. Thank you, Nathaniel.
You're very welcome.
Nathaniel Zimmet, chef and owner of Boucherie and Bourrée. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Come along with us next week. We're going to belly up to the bar at Tales of the Cocktail.
competitions come from a certain level of bartending. It tends to be that women are hired for their assets and yes. not their brain. And that, to me, was a big red flag.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau, by Dickie Brennan's Steakhouse, a local New Orleans steakhouse serving prime beef in New Orleans' French Quarter, and by Toujac's Restaurant, home of America's oldest stand-up bar, now celebrating 160 years on Decatur Street. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Mars. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.